The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 16th of March, 2021. On the podcast today, Richard Holohan, CEO of Polarian Imaging, discusses how their £25 million fundraise will give them the runway to go beyond the FDA PDUFA date to prepare for commercialization and launch. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin, blockchain, cryptocurrency news. And as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most read RNSs too. You can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'd also see lots of the content. In fact, there's one there on block commodities. There's one there on Cadence Minerals. Another one on Salt Lake Potash. Another one on Polarian. And lots of other stuff. Plus, of course, our COVID-19 index. You can see all these stocks there that sort of, you know, do well in the COVID times. And the biggest riser there is Fusion Antibodies. That's up 10.5% to 152. Biggest faller there today is ETH Therapeutics, down 6% to 22 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Holohan, Chief Executive Officer of Polarian Imaging. P-O-L-X is ticker there. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be with you, Justin, as always.
Yeah, and we're going to dig into why you did a very substantial fundraise and highly supported by existing shareholders, directors as well. We'll talk about that and where that's going to take you and what it's going to be used for. But before we do, as always, if you had to explain you know, Polarian to someone now who's not in the medical profession, and you had to say why it's different, what it is about it, just summarise, how would you do that, Richard? How could you keep it simple for someone new to it?
Yes, exactly. And so I think the best way to do that is kind of right off of the title slide in the slide deck, and that is we are both literally and figuratively about breathtaking images, right? Mm-hmm. This is about using our inert noble gas contrast agent Xenon 129 in assessing pulmonary function quantitatively end to end for a pulmonologist. And that is, there's not a question that they can answer about what's going on inside your lungs that we can't answer. And we do that by using magnetic resonance imaging.
Mm-hmm. And just explain what's out there at the moment, because you know you've done a phase three trial, of course, so it was a head to head. Explain what the alternative is for people, you know, who are going in for these for this analysis diagnostics. What do they have there available at the moment?
Sure. And so I think the kind of origin story for us is that in a very cruel twist of physics and physiology, pulmonary medicine was essentially left behind by the revolution that took place in most of the rest of medicine by the introduction of CT and then magnetic resonance imaging. So everything, oncology, cardiology, neurology, musculoskeletal imaging. I mean, if you walk into any of those clinicians' offices on a daily basis, you'll see thousand slice studies up on displays where people are trying to do diagnosis or analysis of disease. Pulmonary medicine is still using technologies that, for the most part, are 100 years old, having to do with trying to assess expired breath. That's the technology called spirometry. Mm. And so we now bring all of the compelling power of three-dimensional, non-invasive imaging to pulmonary medicine, and happily, because most of these patients are assessed recurrently by their doctors, happily using technologies that are not using radiation in any form, which is, I think, key if you're taking care of patients longitudinally.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, in fact, you mentioned the presentation there. I want to pick your brains on two of the slides in there, which are very interesting, I thought. But let's talk about the fundraising first of all. So you raised how much, and what's it going to be used for then, Richard?
Yep. So we raised £25 million. The placing was oversubscribed to both existing and new shareholders, happily. So very happy about that.
Yeah, yeah. And you're saying it provides you with 18 months of cash runway. And more importantly, I suppose, it gets you past that FDA approval date, doesn't it? I say approval, but on the 5th of October, I mean.
Yeah, it does. If you remember kind of our backstory here in capital raising, we've always called a milestone and raised the funds to achieve it. In the last raise, the title of that raise was to get to approval. And I think as we have approached that kind of impending date, our board has been encouraging us to work ahead on hitting that finish line, because it's also the starting line for commercialization. And so I think it became obvious that that to do that well, we needed to raise more money. And if you're launching a drug device combination into the high end of academic medicine in the U.S. market, that is an unforgiving place to not get an A. And so we've now raised the money to set ourselves up to do that.
Yeah, and it's quite reassuring, isn't it, I suppose, the level of support you got. And I mean, 25 million, less than an 8% discount, you know, with existing shareholders. I mean, that's quite reassuring, isn't it?
It is. And I think we're very gratified by that. We've seen other raises earlier this year in the city and are really quite happy with that outcome.
Yeah, and let's be honest, the people taking part in the raise, you know a bit about this industry, like the guys from Bracco, for example, and, at Massey. Yeah. So they're very experienced guys in this field, aren't they?
Yes, and they have come along with us now. And in this raise, we were also able to attract some of the larger funds that we had been calling on from the outset and were kind of not quite big enough, hadn't quite done enough yet to have earned their trust. And then in this round, many of them have come in. So very happy about that as well. It's been a wonderful expansion of the share register in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's say, I mean, there's no way of knowing. I mean, to me, you could say, some people I'm sure say it's nailed on, you've passed phase three. But let's say you get the approval from the FDA and going beyond that, you say launch and then commercialization. How does that look? What do you actually do there? I mean, where do you go after the approval?
That is a great question, and it is the object of all of our work at the moment. So, as a drug device, the regulatory framework precludes us from doing things like taking orders in advance. So, in contrast to kind of commerce at large and retail, where you can pre-sell things and then fill orders, we can't do that. So that is against the rules and can be quite a punitive activity to be caught out in. So, but what we can do is, using the clinical and scientific side of the business, we can begin the process of making presentations to pulmonologists and radiologists about the clinical use of the technology and creating the storyboards that explain a day in the use of this technology on patients for doctors. And so we're hard at work creating those storyboards, and they're very compelling. I couldn't be happier for how those things are developing.
Yeah, yeah, because you've got, so I don't know how many systems you have out there. Is it 20-something,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, we've got 24. Our most recent one, which we did RNS, was the delivery to MD Anderson, the global cancer research facility. They have a very special interest in this, which is, to a certain degree, an expansion kind of outside of pulmonary medicine into oncology. But it's about the use of the technology to assess the planning and progress of all therapies having to do with treating lung cancer. So, as you know, there are many ways to help a patient who has received this diagnosis. One of them is surgery. That was actually one of our clinical trial topics, lobe resection surgery. One of them is radiation therapy, and that's the delivery of radiation doses to tumors in a geometric span around the human body to minimize delivering dose to healthy tissue while maximizing the sum of all those doses at the tumor. And right now, that planning process is kind of an advanced problem in geometry, trying to design those ray paths. And then, of course, chemotherapy, which is delivering some kind of chemistry to the human body, which you know is not good for all of the body, and trying to manage that process in quantity and time to get the highest benefit in killing the diseased cells, but not damage the healthy cells any more than absolutely necessary. And of course, that planning, for the most part, proceeds kind of in the time domain, using a calendar based on, you know, years of medical evidence. So if the object of all that is to preserve the highest degree of pulmonary function ex post those therapies, and many of them are now used in combination, wouldn't it be a compelling thing to do to be able to exactly assess pulmonary function globally within the lung? And the answer is yes, we think so. And those guys, and of course, the folks out at Oxford do this as well. And we think it's simply kind of a recent new development in the technology, taking it in an adjacent direction.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what's one of the slides on your presentation there? I saw this, the study from Oxford University, studying lung imaging. And it's really a standout, you know, image there of COVID scarred lungs. And like you said, that, you know, it was a big market anyway, diseases that affect the lungs. But now, I mean, that there's so much evidence of long COVID, isn't there? I don't know how big the market has become all of a sudden.
Yes. Well, I think just for those, you know, for the agencies who track statistics, COVID patients are now, from a pulmonary function point of view, a segment as large as asthma, which is the largest single segment. And so it is. It's huge. It's unfortunately and desperately huge in that regard. The beauty of the Oxford study was that, you know, weeks after having recovered from having the virus, many patients, and of course, there doesn't seem to be any grand unified theory of this at all. Things are happening in strangely illogical ways with respect to who succumbs, who doesn't, the depth of their state of disease, and their recovery or bounce back after the fact don't seem to have rhyme or reason yet. And so the ability to study the effects of this quantitatively across huge swaths of varying patient populations, we think will ultimately be quite important. And so what that study showed was that many weeks after the fact, and despite appearing normal in other techniques of evaluation, our technology clearly shows that the patients are not normal, and in particularly in the way that they gas exchange and transport gas in arterial blood flow, very much suffering from some form of dysfunction. So hopefully this leads to investigations in therapeutics, either on the front or back end. And clearly, if drug companies were to have existing drugs that might work for treating like symptoms present in other pulmonary diseases, we could certainly help with evaluating those things quantitatively in the most efficient way possible.
Yeah, well, you say that another slide here, but you could simplify clinical trials, increase precision, and lower costs. And there's two sort of bits of data circled on that thing about the number of patients needed. That's phenomenal. There,
it is. It's a startling thing. So everyone would know, and of course, even in the lay press, the scale and cost of drug clinical trials are staggering, right? Mm-hmm. Some of that is associated with the medical evidence that's being sought in the trial, but some of it is simply the precision and reproducibility of the tools that are being used as the endpoints in clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And so they're using the same technology that we began the discussion with, spirometry, which has a difficult profile with respect to its statistical reproducibility. And so if you compare ours versus theirs and simply hand that data to a biostatistician and say, for example, that you would like to run a trial to detect, say, a 2% difference in ventilation defect arising from a drug, hypothetically, and tell the statistician, I want a 90% confidence interval and I want a 0.05 alpha, tell me statistically how many subjects I would have to have in each trial. And on the slide, you can see it there in black and white. It's our case 20. Four in their case 525, their case 542, and so that's just numerically that's a startling contrast. But if you then kind of turn around and transpose that into the cost domain, in our clinical trials, the subjects averaged something on the order of $60,000 or so a piece to do. So the other way to characterize that slide is, which would you rather spend? $1 million or 20 to get the answer yes or no to your question. And I think that's just a staggering difference in cost. And of course, that translates additionally into, I mean, it took us, you know, nearly a year to recruit our clinical trial with 80 patients. How long would it take, or how many institutions running in parallel would it take to recruit 542 patients? And the answer is a lot.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
So I think it's a tremendous opportunity to help kind of evaluate new drugs and respiratory pipelines globally, and we're exploring that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, just, I know we've gone over this before, but surely it's changing now and it's getting bigger. I mean, you talk about the market opportunity there. So, what is the opportunity? And is it possible to model for now long COVID or any COVID related disease or not?
Yeah, I think so. COVID patients and COVID as an epidemiological statement certainly has a unique profile. In terms of its effects on the human body, they fall into the same categories that all pulmonary disease does. And so we can label those images COVID. They could also be labeled something else. It's simply a demonstration of our ability to assess ventilation, gas exchange, and red blood cell transport after the fact and help clinicians understand what is happening here with respect to this disease.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so when you launch now, after assuming FDA approval, how do you know what demand you'll get? Because obviously you know what the potential market size is, I suppose, but have you any idea how much demand you'll get for your systems?
No, there isn't kind of a priori any real way to know. It's not something that you could, you know, for example, I can't conduct a market survey and ask people how many Polarian scans would you like. It's not quite that way. But what we can and do are commission group studies, mm-hmm. By creating advisory boards and putting both existing users and people new or naive to the technology together, and then ask them questions, medical questions in specific disease verticals, mm-hmm. and say, you know, here are the possibilities. Here are the things that we can do. Here are the things that we can't do. Ask them about the way that they currently treat patients, and then create dialogue between clinicians, mm-hmm. About their relative experiences in using the technology and how it might play as a day in the life of a pulmonologist, and then just take notes like crazy and analyze and digest all that. And out of that, we certainly will be creating models about which diseases, which patients, with what kinds or what states of disease might best be candidates for the instantaneous adoption of this technology. And we'll see how those theories play out as we get to market. There's always planning, and then there's always real life when it comes to medicine and how clinicians use tools, how patients play in those theories are all things that, you know, happen in the real world after the fact, and either confirm plans or become new models themselves.
Yeah, yeah. But I suppose what you do know is that, like I said, pulmonary disease affects, what, nearly 40 million people in the U.S. and costs $150 billion. So that's 40 million
pre-COVID. That's now 65. So, wow. So it's a shocking quantity of money. And again, just like the story on clinical trials, why do they cost so much? Why do they take so long? And the answer is because of the tools that are presently being used. So I think we look forward to an outright opportunity in an evidence-based medicine sort of way to help healthcare get their arms around this and spend the money in the highest value way on taking care of these patients.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that's, so it's gone from 40 million to 65 million, and that's just in the U.S., isn't it, you know?
And in a single year, right? I mean, that's a stunning shift, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. And just one question. I've had quite a few people saying, you know, questioning why you changed broker. And I know Steve L. Nicholas are quite a big broker. And so what is that? What advantage is that for you, is switching to broker to those, Richard?
Yeah, well, I think it's an old story. I think many businesses go through this evolution. Mm-hmm. There are segments of the investment community market to call on in London, and then gradually as entities grow in scale and or in the markets they face, they kind of inevitably wind up moving up towards larger markets or larger brokers with bigger windows into markets. And that's exactly what happened in our case. And I would say in a perfectly natural sort of way and to a wonderful outcome. So I'm very happy about all this.
Yeah, exactly. And like you say, you are in America. You're targeting commercially America first, the U.S. And would you you must have considered a listing there, or is that in discussion?
Well, I think in the context of well trodden paths, of course, even just locally there on AIM in London, this is not a sequence of events that would be unexpected. Right now, I think our advice, even from Stifel, is we're a long way from having exhausted London capital markets, but we are a U.S. company. We're domiciled in the U.S. Our first addressable market in the U.S. I think in the longer term, it probably makes sense that we would come here to raise money for any next new big adventure in our story here. Mm-hmm. But all part of the bigger picture consideration.
Yeah, it's all on the table. Marvellous stuff, Richard. As always, if you could, three reasons then. If someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what they're hearing, the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story, three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, so we are the only non-invasive, quantitative, end-to-end assessment of pulmonary function tool that does so reproducibly and without radiation. We are a proven technology. We have 24 systems out there operating in some of the best and brightest academic institutions in the world, having generated 1,000 peer-reviewed journal articles by now. And then finally, we have a demonstrated track record for delivering on milestones and communicating with investors about that.
Excellent stuff, Richard. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time, Justin, as always.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He's the author of The Crypto Trader. He has exactly 2,900 followers on Twitter. And his last tweet was about a guy who reviewed his book, and he gave it one star. He said, "Very poor book." This is from Dipsy Doodle. First of all, I don't believe there's a person called Dipsy Doodle, but you can understand why this person is bitter if their parents named them Dipsy Doodle. You might have to go through life called Dipsy Doodle. Anyway, he goes on, Dipsy Doodle goes on. This book, I don't think this person would find anything in life positive with that kind of name. I'm just going, kids are cruel. I know, Dipsy Doodle. Anyway, this book is a total waste of time. I returned it for a refund. Here's the entire book in one sentence. You can make a lot of money with cryptocurrencies. Now, you have read the book also. Don't waste your time with this book. So this person, even though he's only writing two sentences, quite incapable of writing that grammatically correct. So, you know, take from that what you will. To me, that's a litmus test of the guy's, you know, take into account the guy's name and the fact that he can't write a sentence. Then you've got the measure of the guy. So what's when you see that, Glenn, but we haven't seen the rest of the reviews. I haven't seen them. They're pretty quite good, aren't they, I suppose?
Very good, Justin. I've got an average rating of 4.5 out of 5 from 273 reviewers. Justin, feeling pretty good about things. I did get really annoyed about that because it's so infuriating with, you know, the sarcastic tweet that I attached to that was, this guy has found me out. It's true. My book is only one page long and all it says is you can make a lot of money with cryptocurrencies. And that's all. I was kind of hoping no one would notice. That's the title of the book.
I know, but
maybe he should read some of the words in the book, you know?
Reminds me of when, someone said once, if you've made it in life, you decide to buy yourself a car worth six figures or something ridiculous, you know? You're driving along and you hear, it's state of the art. It smells gorgeous. The stereo is the best. The air conditioning is climate controlled. It's perfect. Everything. It's almost self-driving, you know? And then you hear a little squeak and you get obsessed with that squeak and nothing else matters. And of all the billion parts in that car that's working perfectly, there's one that's not. There's a little squeak somewhere, maybe new upholstery, maybe the leather or something, whatever. But you get obsessed with it. And that's like yours. Now, I'm looking on Glenn Goodman on Amazon. It's got basically a number one bestseller. Amazon's got that next to it. Like I say, you get 273 ratings and 4.5 out of 5. 70% is 5 stars they've given you. But you've chosen to focus on that one negative idiot. Why did you even tweet that out? Because we now need you. If I were you, I would start tweeting out 1,000 other, 270 odd replies, 70% of the replies, give it, 5 stars. Because that's more a measure, an accurate measure of the book than that dipsy doodle.
Well, let's face it, Justin. All the top celebs like myself, we all focus on the negative. And not on the positive. No, seriously, it's like they all do it though, don't they? Stephen Fry. Do you remember? Everybody heaps praise on Stephen Fry constantly his entire life. Oh, he's wonderful. He's so witty, blah, 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 blah. Which he is. He is a witty guy. Yeah. But he has a few trolls on Twitter. This is going back some years now. But, just a handful of trolls. And he would focus on those trolls and get so upset by those trolls. And then he would keep leaving Twitter. Do you remember? He was one of the biggest guys on Twitter. Yeah. And then he kept saying, oh, I can't take it anymore. These people are so nasty to me. I'm leaving. And he'd leave. Yeah, yeah. And everybody, they're like, 10,000 people would write comments Stephen, we love you. Please come back. And so eventually he'd come back. And then another two or three people would slag him off. And then he'd flounce off again. And I guess it's human nature. Everybody seems to focus on the negative comments, 10 times as much as they do on the positive ones. Don't you do that too?
Well, you know what, though? It's an idiot. If I were you, he's an idiot, that guy. And not only that, it's not representative of your book. So all I've seen now is that tweet. I don't know what the ratings are on your book. And most people won't even click to find out. So what you should put it on
there, Glenn. I've given myself bad advertising.
Yeah, but you have. You should say, okay, this one guy, for some reason.
I was making fun of the thing. I was like, it was just a little joke. I wasn't actually saying, I'm so angry.
I know, but let me say, what I'm saying is, what I take from that is that, I don't know whether you just had one review, and that's the guy. That's it. I don't know that. Most people, there's no link to that tweet. So if you're going to do it, say, by the way, 70% of the reasons give it 5 stars. 4.5 is the average. So this guy is very much on his own, if he exists at all, Dipsy Doodle. And I can understand why he's bitter with that kind of name.
It might even be a woman.
Here's a link.
I mean, would a man call himself Dipsy Doodle?
Yeah, maybe. But here's a link to the book on Amazon. Check it out for yourself. There's a marketing opportunity you've missed out on, I think, a little bit.
Well, look, you're saying that I've given myself bad publicity there. The worst publicity was in your introduction to this, when you pointed out that I've got 2,900 Twitter followers, which is not a great number of Twitter followers.
Yeah, but you haven't been on that Twitter that long, have you?
You started
in September. Well, you joined in September 2010, but you weren't very active.
No, I didn't tweet for 10 years or something. Yeah, it's true.
You chose Facebook.
I chose Facebook. So, just for people listening, I still have a quarter of a million followers on Facebook, but actually I prefer to communicate with people on Twitter these days, partly because most of the people who follow me on Twitter are people who've actually read my book, it seems. Well, that's the impression I get from the comments anyway. So you get a really kind of intelligent level of discussion from the old Twitter followers.
Yeah, I do.
Intelligent because they print my book.
I very rarely go on Facebook now, ever, just to post stuff for Vox or something like that. That's what I do it for. I did shut down my account, but I went back on there just to post stuff for Vox because obviously the website there, I have to be on there. So, but yeah, I just find it a bit of a waste of time. I'd never liked it for years. People posting pictures of themselves thinking, I care. I don't care. I really don't care what you're doing. I don't care what you're eating. I don't care where you're taking the dog for a walk. I don't care. Now, if you give some facts and information, I like that. I said today on GMBS, on the treadmill, about to put on a channel that I want to watch while I'm running, and they had Susanna Reid and four other journalists on there. Okay, let's talk about this this woman's protest, the march. I thought, talk about what? I don't care what you're talking about. It's just hot air. Give me some facts that I don't know. Yeah, I'm interested in that. But I don't care about that kind of nonsense, you know? So, well, that's why, of course, a lot of opinion on Twitter, but you also find it's faster moving and it's a bit more fact on there as well. You can find out, I think. But there we are.
Well, I like, though I would say this because I've partnered with them, but I like Voice.com, the new social media network, which has not been in existence for long.
Is that Clubhouse? No.
No, it's Voice, Voice.com.
Is it trying to copy Clubhouse?
No, the name is misleading to some degree. Even though it's called voice.com, there are no actual voices on it like Clubhouse. There are no, you know, there's
really?
No. Well, no, I mean, you can link to audio on it, but it's not an audio channel. It's to voice your opinion. So it's like, you know, that's the what they mean by voice. So it's kind of like a cross between, I see it as a cross between Reddit and Twitter, with all the sort of the best bits, but not the bad bits. And well, to be honest, the best bit is it's somewhat exclusive. I mean, Clubhouse is exclusive to the extent that you have to have an iPhone. You have to be relatively rich to use Clubhouse. So it's exclusive in that kind of plutocratic sense. I'm not a big fan of Clubhouse, but Voice, I like it because basically they verify your identity. And that's kind of the main feature that separates it from something like Reddit or Twitter. You don't get those anonymous idiots writing incredibly rude stuff and hijacking discussions and all of that. Every discussion is really respectful, intelligent people. You know, it's a kind of rarefied atmosphere, but not one that is enforced by how rich you are, like Clubhouse. It's enforced by whether you're prepared to go on the record and show this is who I really am.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a bit like my chat group.
My articles on there for anyone who wants to read articles about investing written by me. They're on voice.com.
I like the way you bigged it up then. It's called an intelligent platform. And then you said, I put all my articles on there, by the way. And that validated. That helps, of course, their brand. It's a bit like my chat group for my share pickers investment club. Very respectful. Oh, Duke of Edinburgh has left hospital. I thought he was dead then. Be honest, you know. Well, with all of us, it's time, isn't it? But I had an alert pop-up saying, Duke of Edinburgh, that's going to happen soon, isn't it? You know, that pop-up where they say, and certainly the Duke of Edinburgh.
Oh, yeah. How old is he now?
99, 100, something like that. He's getting close to 100, isn't he? I don't know if he's there yet, but
he'd have heard, maybe he was turning 100.
Yeah, maybe they're just, keeping him sort of upright for the 100th birthday, you know, give them the bumps.
Well, like Weekend at Bernie's. Remember that film?
Yeah, give them the bumps and then that's it. Don't give them 100 bumps, whatever you do, because that's... No. Anyway, we've gone off the subject a bit, I think. Let's get into crypto.
What are we here to discuss?
So India has banned Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, and that seemed quite well-timed because it was a market high, the Bitcoin was. It was hitting 60,000, wasn't it? Like that? And then India came out and says... It's illegal. They're banning it. Everyone will be killed. And,
was that a dodgy accent you're putting on there?
It's just but the thing is, people try a Welsh accent. They came out as Indian, so I'm just doing a dodgy Welsh accent, you know. So what do they say? When is that kicking in? When will they stop?
Well,
allowing people to do it.
I've been following this whole India thing for years and years. Believe it
but
or not.
Isn't it funny how you can do certain accents? Hang on, you're allowed to do certain accents, but you can't do other accents.
Yes,
why is that?
I know.
Why can I try Scottish and fail miserably, or Irish? And in fact, Irish is now getting a bit dodgy. But or Welsh, definitely can do Welsh. But yet I can't do an Indian or whatever. I can do an Australian, but it's racist if I do anything else. If you're not disparaging, I think it's quite sensible, actually. They've banned Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Let's be honest, it's the Wild West, isn't it?
The accents thing, I would argue, is critical race theory. Are you aware of
Let's go back to crypto.
All right, well, But anyway, the point is you're doing, you know, white accents are generally considered more acceptable than non-white accents, yeah. Put it that way. But that's not an exclusive rule. There are exceptions to it. But as you say, like, that's a whole other discussion.
Can I do a Jamaican accent? Get into... Okay, anyway.
Yeah, you can't anymore. Actually, I was just reading about how Adrian Brody, the actor, did a Jamaican accent on Saturday Night Live a while ago and became persona non grata as a result of that. But anyway, back to...
I think as long as you're not demeaning, what's the problem? It's just a different sound. That's all it is. As long as you're not demeaning in any way, that's fine, isn't it? You know?
It depends on the individual incidents, doesn't it?
Yeah, but
if you're not demeaning
to the race or the culture or whatever, yeah. It's not a race, we're all humans, but I mean the culture, so I think that's fine. You're only trying to give a bit of colour, especially when you're working in audio on podcasts, it helps to give a bit of depth and colour, doesn't it? Can I do Chinese accents these days? I don't know.
I really wouldn't go there. Those always tend to turn out pretty badly when people attend those. But yeah. Anyway. But India. Yeah. I mean, the point is about India. I've been following the whole situation there for years because they keep threatening to ban cryptocurrencies over and over again. And in fact, the Indian Central Bank brought in a kind of ban a few years ago. So people in India are always left in this limbo situation where they're not sure whether they're actually allowed to be doing it or not, depending on which particular authority has said so. Now, if this new ban comes in, it will be organized by central government. So I guess that would have more weight than previous bans. But even so, my experience of friends of mine and also followers of mine in India is that, because I have lots of cryptocurrency contacts over there, is that to a certain degree, they kind of... I do.
Zen is massive in India. Don't you know that? You are huge in India,
cryptocurrency. Anyway, point is, they tend to turn a blind eye a lot of the time. You know, that enforcement is not as efficient, perhaps, as it would be in the UK or the United States. So a lot of Indian people I know just go, oh, I'm not paying any attention to that. Or at least that's what they did when the central bank was telling them not to engage with cryptocurrency. I suspect it might be the same again, unless this ban is enforced, you know, properly, which I doubt. Look, it hasn't even come in yet. I'm not convinced. As I say, there have been so many false bans in India in the past that I won't believe it until I see it.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Bitcoin price, and every high we've had recently, even from the 40,000 to the 50,000, there's been a lower RSI high. So that shows momentum slowing down a bit, and the MACD is rolling over. I'm thinking this is, I don't know, well, there's more hype now. Again, we said, you know, the crypto winters will be shorter now because there's more support generally in the main markets and the mainstream. Mm. But I'm still thinking it's going to roll over soon. It's going to exhaust itself a little bit because it's been running very hot, hasn't it?
It has, but when you look at the charts, okay, it's had...
I'm looking at the chart, Glenn.
it's had something of a dip of late, but I've drawn one of my parabolic curves, and it hasn't broken that curve. In fact, as of this morning, it's just bounced off that curve again. The uptrend is still looking solid, but I agree with you that the recent correction that we've experienced in the past few days, we're talking now on Tuesday morning, so the correction that started on Sunday, feels a little premature because we've only just had a new all-time high. And if you look at the previous all-time high, it was followed by a huge burst upwards. And that was the same for previous all-time highs before that as well, back in December and January. And now, yeah, when you look at the most recent all-time high that we've just made, the price managed to break out, but then fell back almost immediately to below that, to below the previous all-time high. So I guess what I'm, to cut a long story short, what I'm trying to say is this is a weaker breakout than the ones that we've seen previously in previous months. And you're quite right that is not a good sign. So
are you long
call
or short,
it a first tiny little early warning sign. I'm still long cryptos generally because the trend is upwards. It's still upwards. Okay, this might be a little bit of an early warning sign. It might not. It's too early to tell. But, you know, and until I see a proper serious warning sign, I'm going to carry on being long because it would be crazy to be anything other than long in such a bullish market.
Yeah. Have you now become a bit more, you know, sort of less of a dirty trader?
Well, put it this way, my most profitable cryptocurrency trades slash investments have been the ones that I've been holding on to for some considerable time.
There we are. Just proves, yeah. Disproves your theory, doesn't it?
Well, no, so, it doesn't disprove anything because I've always been a trend follower. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I follow the trends. I don't buy in it. I'm not a day trader. It's the first thing I say in my book. I'm not a day trader.
Hang on. I look for evidence. First thing you say in the book, the crypto trader. Ben Goodman was ITV News. He realized they were reporting extra cash for him.
Maybe not on the first page.
He famously turned £3,000 trade into £100,000 by betting. Betting, you dirty betting, dirty trader. There was a financial crash in 2008, an experience he later recounted in the Times. Ooh. He worked in a business correspondent with Therese, and interviewing Theresa May, Boris Johnson, and David Cameron, among others. Really?
Yeah.
With his growing trading income, Glenn was able to leave his job in his 30s, the 1930s, and he started trading cryptocurrencies. His favorite page, The Shares Guy, becomes the biggest trading page in the world. You obviously wrote this yourself, didn't you? He is now regularly interviewed by the media, including BBC, Forbes.
This is publisher's publicity.
You wrote this. You said, just big up yourself on the front page and we'll do it in third person. and is contributing expert on cryptocurrency at the London School of Economics. Okay, so that's the first. Okay.
Look, please don't go searching for my slagging off of day trading. I can't remember what page it was on. It's quite near the start.
What this book is not. This book is not just a cloth to wipe you.
We've got to talk about the crypto.
This book is not toilet paper to wipe your backside. What this book is not about, how cryptocurrencies work and how the technology will change the world. If that's what you're after, just Google. How do cryptocurrencies work and how will their technology change the world?
That's cost
you, cost you nothing and tell you. You don't say this is.
It costs you nothing. See,
the
I'm
first thing you say. Hang on. The first thing you say is not, you're not a day trader.
Do I?
You say what the book is not about. It's the preface. The preface.
The preface. Look, we got it. I got a piece of crypto news. Can I just say the crypto news before you dig even deeper? I mean, you know, this is all great free publicity for my book, but I feel like the listeners need to know the big news of the week. Apart from that India thing, there is also NFTs that we were talking about last week, non-fungible tokens. Yes. They're the latest thing. They're all exciting. Every token is programmed to be different from every other token. And so you can program them with, for example, a JPEG or a piece of music sort of within the token itself, sort of wrapped within the token, as it were. And then you can buy and sell these things.
Yes.
So we were talking last week about how some of them are sold for silly amounts, but now it's gone truly crazy because a simple JPEG, has sold for $69 million.
That guy who sold that must still be laughing his head off.
He was. There's a video of him actually laughing his head off at this, quite literally. Because until 6 months ago, he was an impoverished artist, And now he's selling for $69 million his piece called Every Days, The First 5,000 Days. Because what this guy, Beeple, who, did we mention Beeple last week? I don't think we did. But Beeple is a digital artist. And for 5,000 days, they're called Every Days, these pieces, because every day for the past 5,000 days, he has been producing a digital sketch, kind of like a political sketch that you might see in a newspaper, except often cruder and more extreme, but still satirical, sort of political satire, sort of like a big fat naked Donald Trump fighting with a naked Joe Biden. It's that kind of stuff, right? And it's witty and it's interesting. But he's been doing this for 5,000 days and not making much money at all. And his wife's, you know, had a full-time job trying to support the family and all the rest of it. And then suddenly he discovers NFTs about 6 months ago. Somebody suggests to him that it's a good way to sell your artwork digitally because then these things can be passed backwards and forwards between people. And before you know it, the guy's artworks are selling for hundreds of thousands of dollars, then millions of dollars, and now finally for $69 million to an anonymous buyer who we know is a crypto investor. So the thing is, you know, this is mania, is it not? This is an example of extreme market mania. And it reminds me of nothing so much as the Japanese boom in the late 80s. I don't know if you were in sort of reading the papers all the way back then, Justin, but the situation, I remember it from the time, from when I was at school. I remember reading or being told by my dad or something about how there was a massive art boom in Japan and that brand new pieces of artwork by Japanese artists, you know, even relatively unknown artists were selling for tens of millions of dollars, that kind of thing. And it was a sign of the froth at the very market top. And as we know, Japan's market crashed, the art market completely crashed, the housing market, everything crashed in Japan. And the stock market is still nowhere near back to where it was in 1989. So that was a historic crash that is still working its way through the system. And, you know, if this is an analogy of that, then that worries me.
Yeah, you're saying this, it is a bit nuts. I often wonder if really he hasn't got 69 for it. I'm just thinking, who's going to pay that? I don't understand who's going to pay that. Is it a scam? Is he just saying this to get some?
No, because Christie's sold it. This is a Christie's auction.
Oh, is it really? God,
Who's buying that? It's totally official. What was the name of the guy who bought it? It was.
How do you make a profit on that? No one's going to buy that off you. No one, are they?
An online, the price was new. Where is it? I don't think they're saying. Yeah, it's still anonymous. We haven't got a name for the buyer. But as I say,
Christie's are in the promotional business.
So investor.
Christie's are in the promotional business. So is that guy. I think they're just making it up, to be honest. I really do.
You think Christie's have made it? Christie's don't make stuff up. They're respectable.
Of course they do. Oh, they're called Christie's. No, they need. How is it always Christie's who gets the publicity? Of course they're making it up. They just get together that guy and say, let's just pretend. No one's going to know.
Not pretend. I don't believe
because
that.
It's perfect. They say the guy that bought it wants to remain anonymous because he's an idiot for buying it at that price. He realizes that now.
Yeah, but $69 million actually has to change hands, doesn't it? And, you know, go through their accounts and all the rest of it and be audited.
What they won't be publicising.
You can't ignore that.
Yeah, no, but what they won't be publicising is the fact that they'll say, oh, it turns out this guy has decided against it. He realizes he's being a bit carried away and he hasn't got the money. That's what I'm saying.
Well, like when someone drunkenly bids on eBay.
Yeah, exactly. He was very drunk. He thought, this is a good idea. And he thought it was 6.9.
Well, I was very drunk at the time.
Pound. He thought it was 6.9 pound. But he got he couldn't see the decimal point. It's very small. He's got bad eyesight. I can't see anyone paying 69 million for that, can you?
Anyway, they did, but the reason is obvious. It's the exact same reason why Japanese investors were paying tens of millions for unknown artists' artworks back in the 80s. It's because, A, they got too much money because the crypto market's been going insane. So these crypto investors, some of them have, you know, become billionaires in a very short space of time. Yeah. And you know, likewise, it was the Japanese stock market that was going crazy in the late 80s. So these people were kind of cash happy. But the second reason, of course, is that they don't think they're wasting their money. They see it as an investment. Just as you bought your NFT for $100 last week, the Kings of Leon album, because you're hoping that it'll be worth more in the future.
This guy spent 69 million,
hoping that it'll be worth 690 million in a few years' time.
It's not, is it? Because there are. If you look at the amount of people, right? First of all, the amount of Kings of Leon fans there are, and look how many people can afford $100, and then you look how many people are fans of that one bit of art, and they can afford $69 million. It's a very small market. That, I mean, you know, even 10% is like, phew, that's ridiculous. You're not going to get. Who's going to buy that? Who's as insane as you? It's ridiculous.
Elon Musk? Maybe Elon Musk will buy it. There you go.
He knows. No, his missus is.
You know he might.
His missus is producing those scams as well. So why would anyone get involved?
Because this is Beeple. Beeple is like the king of the NFT industry. This is his masterpiece. This 5,000 days thing is Beeple's masterpiece. Even though it's a JPEG that anybody can look at because it's widely available on the internet, the actual, that's the most insane part of this, is that the ownership of it is currently worth $69 million, and maybe Elon would pay, you know, $300 million. Maybe this guy could make an enormous profit by selling it to somebody who's even richer than him, like Elon, who's got, what is it, $100 billion? No, so he could spend a billion on this and not even notice it.
No, I think even Elon wouldn't do that, because he's on the laughing side of that equation, because his missus is producing them and they're just laughing their heads off thinking, who's buying these stupid things? Ridiculous. So no, I can't see that there.
I suppose Elon is laughing at all of us all the time. That's the feeling I always get.
So hang on, are you just literally
laughing at us constantly?
Are you literally now just long everything? And how is your portfolio these days? Are you near a high? How's it going? What's going on?
Yeah. Because the market's at an all-time high. So my crypto portfolio is at an all-time high. My stock portfolio is almost back at a high as well, because obviously stocks have recovered quite strongly from that dip that we had last week. So that's looking good. Everything's generally looking good, a bit suspiciously too good at the moment, which makes me nervous. But yeah, things are good financially.
Okay.
Things are very good.
Yes. The share guy. Why didn't you post anything on
there? Sugar.
Well, the shares guy. Why didn't you post anything on your Facebook anymore?
I do sometimes, but sort of temporary posts, as is often the case with Facebook pages these days. Not ones that necessarily stay on the page.
Come on, Glenn. Well, post this podcast on there. Let's go see if the listens go up. Because you've got 246,000 people like it. 247,000 people follow it. So let's see what kind of traction we get. I dare you.
For what?
Just post this podcast on there.
Oh, this podcast? This podcast?
Actually, I find those are
the ones that gain the least traction, because I would have to post an exterior link, right? And Facebook do not like them links. If you try posting on a Facebook page, for example, on your Facebook page, a link to a YouTube video, it's like Facebook will show it to almost nobody.
Yeah, but hang on.
Like, you can have quarter of a million followers and Facebook will go, oh, we're not showing that link to anybody, because, I don't know, their algorithm must be, I'm guessing, must be programmed to not like exterior links, because it takes people away from the little Facebook garden, doesn't it, you know?
Yeah, but hang on, you're not posting anything on there. You may as well try something.
Well, I do. Like I said, I do temporary posts, but
this is not a good example.
I do posts, but just not ones that necessarily stay and sit on that page forever. But ones with links in perform extremely badly. That's what I'm saying.
Glenn's winning trades, crypto profits.
Oh, just will you stop?
Well, that's all available on your website. There, I've clicked through from the shares guy.
Right.
It's like the beginning of the internet. Many industries that have nothing to do with finance could be transformed by cryptocurrency.
Yeah, they will.
Actually, Tango is a cryptocurrency expert. Oh, expert. All right.
Yeah. I'm a self-pronounced expert. That's me. No, I advise the London School of Economics there. That makes me an expert, surely, doesn't it?
Do you advise them? And what do you say to them? Don't buy crypto at the moment. Buy now. What do you say to the men?
I contributed to like their cryptocurrency course, like the course that they sell to students, particularly to overseas students.
That's wonderful.
It was a wonderful time helping the LSE, a renowned institution.
Okay.
Look, why are you just blathering on now and just kind of browsing my site? Shouldn't this podcast have some kind of structure?
I'm like a digital stalker talking to you. All I'm saying is, post a link on there, give it a try. This is not a good example of a good podcast, but say, listen to this rubbish, and just put that on there and say, listen to this rubbish we're just blathering on. But if, for example, let's finish on this then. If someone's looking to get in now on the crypto space, would you say, no, hold off, there's no opportunities in any cryptos whatsoever, or is there one that hasn't rallied with the rest?
Yes, there are some that haven't. There are some that I've still got my eye on, yeah. I wish you hadn't asked this right at the end of the podcast, because I need to like look them up and find the right ones. Maybe I should prepare it for next week instead. I'll do it for next week.
Surely it'll be different next
week. Because you haven't prepared me for this, and I need to, I need to dig them out, find my watch lists and all the rest of it. And that will take some minutes. So that's something to look forward to for me on next week's podcast.
Bloody hell.
You didn't tee me up. You've got to tee me up if you want.
It's a podcast about crypto. Surely you should be ready for that. Now, next week, they'll be different. It changed. People have lost a week's worth of money-making, you know?
Is that well, actually, saying? This week isn't so great anyway. There's,
oh, there we are. Then.
I mean, in terms of setups.
Okay. Oh, man, perfect. Ideal. Marvellous. I'll head that one off. Right. Cheers, Glenn.
All right. Hold on. I'll give you one. Because I feel like people will be shortchanged otherwise. Here's one. There's a lovely symmetrical triangle building in HNT. If you look up HNT, just those three letters, it's a cryptocurrency. It recently had a massive breakout. In fact, one that I missed, I did a tweet about that. If you have a look, you'll see that I tweeted that I bought it and then set a very tight stop loss, far too tight, and was stopped out during the night, and then the price exploded upwards. It's now been consolidating for about 5 days and forming a nice kind of what you might call a flag or pennant. Not really a flag, more a pennant pattern, which is kind of like a triangle, symmetrical triangle, and it's still forming, and that tends to be a nice continuation pattern, so it could really break out. So I won't be buying it yet. I'll only be buying it if it breaks out from that pattern.
Why did you put a stop loss there? That was too tight. And you say, yeah, along with that, you say, experts are human too. We can screw up.
Look, the way you say that makes it sound condescending, but I put experts in inverted commas, did I not? So I was being kind of ironic. Just like experts, you know, so-called experts.
This should
like
have been a highly profitable trade. I bought the breakout, set a stop loss that was too damn tight. I should have set it below the breakout line I've drawn, but I set it too high, and it triggered while I was asleep. Yep. Just got an angry face, sweary, you know.
Yeah, because I was annoyed with myself, because like, I think I've said this thing even last week, but Stephen Goldstein, the other podcast bloke, said a very clever thing some months ago that sticks in my mind, which is that experts or sort of top traders make all the same mistakes that that novice traders do. It's just or most of the same mistakes anyway, but they just make them less often. That's what becoming a good trader is all about, is just learning discipline, learning to try and minimize the mistakes. You can still make human mistakes and still make lots of money as long as those mistakes
are human mistakes as opposed to what? As opposed to what other kind of mistakes?
Inhuman mistakes.
Like alien mistakes. Yeah. Right. Marvellous. Glenn, thanks for that. I just felt like we, you know, that guy a while back who doesn't enjoy us. See, that's another thing. That one guy who didn't like to just commented on our podcast saying you talk about Bitcoin a lot. No, it's, well, you know, that's one thing that sticks out my mind now when, you know, generally people say they love it. In fact, guys, I had someone on the chat group this week laughing at me calling you a dirty trader. It was quite funny. Anyway, Glenn, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak you next week.
Bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Codal Minerals, up 40% to 0.142. At four, 88 Energy, down 10% to 1.175, big rise yesterday. At three, My Health Check, down 10% pretty much to 4.5. At two, Ferro Alloy Resources, that's up 62% to 24.6. And at one, Canadian Overseas Petroleum, it's up 9.29 to 0.383. Okay, it's time for the top five most read RNSs. They are as follows. At five, Canadian Overseas Petroleum, conditional suspension cancellation listing. At four, Oriel Resources, investment update on Thani Stratex Resources. At three, Arc Minerals, surrender of share options. At two, Amigo Holdings, regulatory update. And at one, Polarian Imaging, results of placing subscription and PDMR dealings. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.